It was a pleasure this morning to have Guy Orbison fill in pulpit. Very fine speaker. Just as a note for others that might have to do a gospel meeting sometime or follow someone who's an eloquent speaker, I'll give you the words of Clint Eastwood, who got co-starred with Richard Burton, a very eloquent Welsh actor, in Where Eagles Dare. He said, "Just give me a gun and let me shoot people." You never try to compete with them. So what you're going to get this evening, instead of an eloquent speech, is a lot of pictures. Okay, and so really all these things are, these PowerPoints are slideshows. So that's what you're going to get. From your handouts in Psalms 8, the second passage at the top, he talks about who has displayed thy splendor above the heavens. It's not a question. Who has displayed thy splendor above the heavens? Okay. Or Psalms 19:1, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the works of his hands. Viewing this, we're going to be looking at just how the heavens do that. As we look at, as we put it this way, the nature of God, when one considers the glory of God, what he's trying to do is comprehend his very nature of the almighty power and wisdom emanating from God. I mean, this is what the heavens unfold. As you look at them and really understand what's out there, it has to leave one impressed, because it's just beyond our ability to comprehend both the wisdom that designed it and the power that brought it into being. In fact, the more one understands the universe that surrounds us, the more one is impressed with the awesome and incredible force needed to bring it into creation. And something even more. It's not that it brought it into creation, but also has to maintain it. And I hope you'll get this out of the things we're going to be looking at this evening. That God is the creator is evident, not only from the fact that it's impossible statistically for all the wonders of astronomical science to be a matter of chance. We looked at that not too long ago. Statisticians say, if anything is beyond 1 to 10 to the 50th, it's an impossibility. So when Carl Sagan comes out and goes, "Oh, the probability of the Earth, of the creation of the Earth, is 1 in 10 to the 250th," what he's saying, and unknowingly, is that it's impossible for it to happen by chance. It needs a designer. Okay? But not only that, what we're also going to be looking at is the insight of the universe in the Scriptures. I mean, what tells us to look for the glory of God in the heavens? God's Word. God directs us that way. And so God's Word is going to help us to recognize what we're looking at, even as we view it. Beginning with what God told Moses, 1450 B.C. Genesis 1:14, "Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years." When Moses refers to the heavens where the stars are, he calls it an expanse. The King James Version uses the word firmament, reflecting the translator's knowledge of science at the time. They thought the stars were set in place, and therefore there's something firm out there, so they called it a firmament. They believed that the stars were locked in their positions. The universe was, a set piece of work. Not to view them too harshly or consider them too harshly, it wasn't until recently, about 1917, that even Albert Einstein, when he first considered his own formulas, I mean, as he was working out the mathematics for the universe, he looked at it and his own formulas said, "We live in an expanding universe." And he couldn't believe his own formulas. So he rewrote them, fudged them, to represent that the outer regions of space are static. It wasn't until 1928, 1930s actually, that Edwin Hubble using the new Palomar Observatory, new at the time anyway, and that's him up there, India, unless you can't see him. It was that big. I mean, the mirror you had to make for this thing was an incredible feat of engineering itself. But when he looked through that, and what he did, as you see this here, you point, and I guess I can use the laser on this thing even better. This part right here, what he did was take the light that came in through the telescope and he ran it through a prism. And what he got was a spectral band up there. And you notice you get, you know, then a kind of a rainbow from, you know, violet to infrared, or to the red. And that's what he saw out there, you know, coming in, was this spectral analysis of not only the sun, but also the stars. And what occurred, what he noticed in the spectral band, is that as he was looking at all the various spectrums of all the stars, he's noticed most of them had a redshift. Okay? And what that meant was that most of the universe is expanding away from itself. So that's why that's when he formulated the Big Bang Theory. Because as you're looking, all the stars are kind of still expanding out. Okay? Interestingly enough, they give you the Hebrew text here, and look at this word. It talks about the expanse, the Hebrew word there, rakia, Moses used to explain, and it's explained by Jacinius, he's a lexicographer, writes dictionaries for the Hebrew language. The meaning is to spread out by beating, as in a tin plate. It is a metallurgical term describing how metal spans out as you hammer it. And this is the way he's describing where the heavens are. An expanse, not just expanded, but a spreading out expanse, as if it's still being hammered out. That's the term that was used, or God gave to Moses, as he looked at this. So God describes the heavens as a spreading out expanse. Then, you know, added to this, as we go back to this, you'll look at the word here, and you have to read this from right to left, it's Hebrew, okay? And so God made the two. Now, when you get to the word light, this is the word. This is literally a luminary. It's not just a light can be any kind of source. But the actual literal Hebrew, they use the term luminary, you know, the great light to rule the day, or the great luminary to rule the day, and the luminary small to for the rule of the night. Okay, and in each case, they're termed luminaries. Now, what that means is that they're independent light sources. So when you get, you know, look in some of your translations, and see even some of the modern ones, still insert, you know, you notice right about here, to rule the night, they insert the word moon because they figure the moon is the light by night that God appointed. But the moon is not a luminary. Okay, it just reflects sunlight. And it's not there during the night all the time. Especially if we just went through a new moon phase, it gets blackened out. And then half the time, you can see the moon during the day because it's not up at night. Okay? So they knew what they were talking about when they referred to not the moon, but the stars here as self-appointed light sources. Okay? And that's what Hubble found. As he put this starlight through the prism, each one had its own spectral bands. You know, they were independent. They were not all alike. They weren't just reflecting the sun. Each one, in fact, as you look at not only the colors, but the little dark bands that are inside there, each one's different, showing that each one is composed of different elements. Each one is its own sun, burning away its own elements that are contained in it. They're luminaries. And this is the way God describes, you know, the night sky, you know, full of these luminaries. Now, a little bit of an explanation when we get down to this word "and." You know, the problem is actually the word, the letter vav here, that's "and." Okay, so you got to figure out what's the rest of this mean. Okay? Now, you'd have to figure out as you look at it, pick a definition for it. One of them, you know, that little word means plowshare, and you go, oh, that doesn't fit. Okay. But other explanations for it are in this same that it's talking about, this luminary is the stars. Okay. Or they shall be called is another thing to it. In fact, let me back up here a little bit. If we go back to this, you can find this word "and" in the "and" here. Where is it? Okay, there it is again. And that's the plural, so it goes from, you know, it to them or whatever. So it, just substitute that in there. And them, or they, the stars. Now, let's get through this. So, Moses identifies the stars as luminaries, or self-contained light sources. Again, man did not know this until Hubble discovered it in the 1930s. 3,500 years later. Okay. God knew it 3,500 years before Hubble did. Okay. Let these things sink in. Previously, the stars were considered to be reflectors of the sun, pinholes in the canopy of the night by which the fires of hell, you know, showed through, or planets or whatever, where angelic beings, yeah, the opinions were very broad. It wasn't until, you know, the last century that they actually started finding out for sure what these things were. Okay. Now, add to this what God told Job. In Job 38, it said, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Where were you?'" You know, he gives a whole list of things. But one of them, "When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." Now, we're going to look at this, you know, when all the stars sang. When God told Job about the stars singing, he used the Hebrew word renan, which interpreted means to emit a stremulous and stridulous sound like a mast or a pole in the wind, but it's never articulate. Okay. Up until recently, no man has ever even thought about the stars saying anything or making any kind of sound. It wasn't until the 1950s at Bell Laboratories that the science of radio astronomy was born. At first they thought it was some sort of interference from enemy jamming devices because it was messing up our radars. When they finally pinpointed the source, they found out it wasn't coming from Earth, it was coming from the heavens. The biggest noise was coming from our own sun. They finally determined, you know, that the stars were emitting sound, so they started listening to the stars. In fact, they really had to listen hard, because in the first 10 years of radio astronomy, cranking it up to really kind of hear what's going on out there, if you gathered all the energy they collected in the first 10 years, it amounts to the amount of energy released by a single snowflake hitting the ground. I mean, is your hearing that good? So, you know, yeah. It's not something that somebody just kind of comes upon and go, oh yeah, you know, it was a really quiet night and I heard the stars. You know, you don't fall over this by accident. So as they began to make the instruments bigger, the radio dishes began to expand by the one, like the size of the one built in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. This thing fills a limestone valley. And you point it by moving this. Now, how big this thing is, if you just use, say, like this little dot here, that's about the size of a man. If you want to know, yeah, what it really looks like, rent the James Bond movie GoldenEye, because this is where, you know, James Bond and the bad guy have their final death, you know, fighting on top of this array. Okay, and that's how big it is. In fact, that's about the only thing they can use it for anymore. You know, it's become kind of obsolete. Rather, what they found, instead of making one big dish, if we have a lot of little dishes lined up, it's the same thing. So you get something like these lined up for 26 miles out of the desert in Socorro, New Mexico, so that they can listen to the stars. Yeah. However, all they heard was what God described to Job 4,000 years ago. There's nothing more. There's no intelligence out there, you know, no Morse code coming in, no any kind of, you know, mathematical, what do they call them, progressions or anything. It's just a noise, like a wind blowing through a mast. But note, God also mentions when the morning stars sang together. It could be that at one point God did gather them all together and then start hammering it out. Okay? And if that turns out to be true, just remember who said it first. Also, we know what God told the psalmist about 1000 B.C. Psalms 115, verse 16, says, "The heavens are the heavens of the Lord, but the earth He has given to the sons of men." Okay? So how far do you think we can get in outer space? And what are you going to find when you get there? For all of man's desire to conquer outer space, recent discoveries may preclude man from venturing very far from his own planet. For one thing, cost is a factor. We can't even go to the moon anymore. Can't afford it. Okay? But we still dream. The thing is, as science develops, what we've been looking at, you know, this spectrum here is the electromagnetic spectrum. And through ocular telescopes, we look at this small window here. And what we see is a fairly, you know, quiet sky. We've also looked at, you know, the radio telescopes, which look at this portion of the spectrum. But the latest advances have taken us with machines that look at this part. With the advance of X-ray telescopes, the stars have taken on a more sinister aspect. Rather than the cold void often depicted in science fiction movies, the universe is a very hot place. The night sky really lights up as we look at the X-ray energy that's out there. And our own sun is relatively cold compared to the magnitude of just about every other star that's out there, especially the exploding kind like the supernovas. The radiation out there is tremendous. Trying to get into that or buy it or whatever may be an impossibility. Also, the distances are very daunting. The nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is 4.3 light years away. That is light traveling 186,000 miles a second. Still takes over 4 years to get there. Okay. Or to put it another way, looking at it from the other side, if Alpha Centauri burned out, we wouldn't know about it for over 4 years. It would take it that long for us to discover that the light wasn't coming from there anymore. The next star, Alpha Canis Minoris, is 11.4 light years away. I mean, this is as close as you can get. As far as we know, there's no planets around these stars. So where are we going? It's almost seven times brighter than our sun, and many of the 7,000 visible stars we look at look dim only because they're so far away. But they're really a lot brighter and a lot hotter than our old little sol that sits out there giving us a nice warm day every once in a while. All this not only begins to limit man in his speculation about interstellar travel, I mean, just, you know, looking at it, from what we got, right now all we have is a space shuttle. Okay. This thing doesn't move. I mean, even if we kept the boosters on it, once we got it into space and kept it going, in fact, even if we like tied a hydrogen bomb to its tailpipe and set it off like a cherry bomb to really shoot it out there, it still will travel only a fourth the speed of light. That means the nearest star to get to is about 16 years away. Okay? So we send somebody there, they get back, and probably generations have already died out. And for what? There was nothing there when they got there. This brings us into an understanding, you know, of the magnitude of what's beyond our atmosphere. The universe, and unbelievable, the unbelievable, you know, not only the distances, but the power of God. I mean, if you can even begin to conceive of the distance and how, you know, powerful these suns are, God made it. I mean, one of the things we looked at, you know, a little while back was, you know, in the speculation of creation and the Creator. Anytime something is made, its maker has to be far greater than what is made. Has to be. And so, as you look at all the science that has to be explored in this, as you look at all the power that's there, however impressive it gets, and it's even beyond our ability to be impressed with the magnitude of it, God still has to be a lot more powerful and a lot smarter. And that's what we got to understand. You know, the more we get into this, the more we look at it, the more we understand it, we should be very much impressed about the Creator of it all. You know, chance plays less of a factor into it, and the Designer comes in, you know, in all of His glory. Psalms 33:6, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of His mouth all their hosts. That is, He spoke it into existence. I mean, it was nothing for Him. Yeah, He said, I'd like to create a universe, and it was there. But not only that, still got the same verse here. In Hebrews 1:3, which was covered this morning, He upholds all things by the word of His power. All this power that's out there has to be maintained. I mean, what keeps all the suns from going off all at once? Even our own. You know, what harnesses the whole thing and makes it work for our benefit and for God's? He does. He still maintains it. All of this, the vastness of it, the power of it, still in the palm of His hand, being maintained, being worked, being brought about, you know, for our benefit. Add one more thing here. What God told Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31:37, thus says the Lord, if the heavens can be measured. Look at the context. He goes, if you can measure the heavens, then I will cut off or cast off the offspring of Israel. Or Jeremiah 33:22, as the host of heaven cannot be counted, nor the sands of the sea, so I will multiply the descendants of David. God tells Jeremiah just how vast the universe is. Now, what we know of our universe, nebula shine with the equivalent intensity of a trillion suns. And their radio source is known as a quasar. One is placed as the most distant known object in the universe and is receding at 149,000 miles per second. Now, try to get your mind wrapped around this. This number here, okay, the Earth is 24,000 miles around. I understand the last class I took on this. Okay. Now, it took me 2 days just to get halfway around the world when I went to India. Okay. This quasar is moving away from us at six times. I mean, if light was going around, if it was going around our Earth, it would go around the Earth six times in 1 second. And that's how fast it's moving away from us. And that's the farthest known thing that we know of, and there's more beyond it. Ptolemy counted 1,056 stars and claimed they would not exceed 3,000. That was in 150 AD. In 1910, Simon Newberry was considered the best astronomer at the time, and he said the farthest star was only 3,260 miles away. This is how rapidly our knowledge of the universe has grown in just 100 years. Okay. What we know now is that there are now 100 billion suns in our galaxy. Yeah. This is like a big spinning dish of suns, 100 billion of them. Our sun sits right on the edge someplace. In fact, when you look at the night sky and a clear sky and you see the Milky Way, what you're looking at is the thick part of this in our own galaxy. But now they speculate or estimate there are trillions of known galaxies. I mean, if this is impressive with 100 billion suns in it, there's over a trillion of these that we estimate. We're in the century of trillions. Before, it used to be impressive if somebody was a millionaire and then a billionaire. Now the number that's thrown out is trillions. Well, God's had the trillions out there all the time, and even more. As a summary of what we've looked at, man discovered that his universe expanded in the 1930s. But 3,500 years before that, God told Moses we lived in an expanding universe. In the 1950s, man discovered that the stars make sound. But God told Job 4,000 years ago that the stars emit sounds. Man discovered space is vast and hot in the 1970s with the X-ray telescopes. But God told the psalmist in 1000 BC, you really don't want to go there. It's mine. The earth is yours. Take care of it. This is where you're going to be for a long time until I destroy it. Man discovered the stars are numerous. In 1608, when Galileo got a telescope, and began to look at the night sky and realized there's a lot more there than we've been looking at. Okay? But God told Jeremiah in 600 BC, almost 2,000 years ago, that the amount of stars you're going to find out there are numberless. At some point in time, God is going to invite us into his realm. You're not going to get there by the Starship Enterprise, and you're not going to take Stargate 1. Okay? It's not going to be a vehicle that does the transporting. God, in his power, is going to draw us into his world. Are you ready to go? That's the big question. Are you accepting the proper invitation so that you will step into the next life in a world of wonder, undescribable, into the very essence and awesome power and glory of God, and there to spend eternity? But you have an alternative. You can step in the other part of his universe, a void of loneliness and awesome torment. Forever. The choice he gives to us. If we are obedient, he says, I know what you have to suffer, and I will reward you accordingly, no matter what you have to face. I'm a God of comfort, and I'm a God of grace. I will take care of you. I will more than reward you for whatever you have to suffer through, and you won't even notice, you won't be a part of it. One of the latest football movies I was watching, they're down to the last few seconds, and they've got to make it to beat the other team, and they're all tired and they're worn out and they're all scarred and bloody and everything else, and the quarterback gets them down the huddle and goes, I guarantee you this one thing. If you can make it across the goal line, you will not feel the pain or the tiredness, because the joy of winning will be so great that it'll completely eclipse everything else. This is what God invites us to. If there's anything we can do to help you Yeah. Respond to that invitation. If there's more you need to know about the nature of God, if there's more you need to know about what He requires of us, you know, if you're ready already to enter, you know, to commit yourself to God through confession and repentance and baptism, you know, we can help you accomplish that this very hour. Or if you've already began to make the journey and realize it's an awesome thing, you know, what God has called us to is special among men, then we realize that, you know, sometimes we're going to fail a little short. If you need our prayers, whatever help, we're here for each other. Now, this is what God gives the church for, that we can help each other along the way, to be there for one another, so that, man, we can all be in God's presence for eternity. We really don't want to lose a single one. Won't you come as we stand to sing?